I have written an MP3 encoder and a video podcast visualizer in Go as part of our production pipeline for this here podcast.
Not in Bash.
No, not in Bash.
Those days are long gone, Mark. that's a distant memory of everything being written in Bash. Now
you've changed, is, man.
Yeah,
I thought I knew you.
I know. It's not in Python either, right? So all bets are off. So yeah, now we're doing all of this post-production work ourselves. It was time to recreate some tools that we used to use when we did the Ubuntu podcast. So back in the day, I wrote a tool for the Ubuntu podcast called PodPublish that did a whole bunch of stuff. And part of that was encoding the MP3 files that, you know, go in the feed, and also making an MP4 video for YouTube with an audio visualizer, you know, as something to put on YouTube for people that want to listen to the podcast on YouTube.
Not our beautiful faces.
No, I think it's best that, you know, our faces for radio remain as faces for radio. Although we have put our fat faces on our YouTube thumbnails.
I put it to you. Two fat faces and one svelte face.
Yes, that's fair, actually. Yes, it is two fat faces, yes. So, we wanted to automate our processes as much as possible. So I decided to write new versions of some of the tools that we had back in the day with PodPublish, and I didn't want to use Python.
Did, as I recall, PodPublish was a shell script originally, wasn't it? I remember Tony wrote something back in the early days. I can't remember what his thing was called. Maybe his was called PodPublish as well, but I remember he used to use Darks as his VCS. That's the only thing I remember about it, is I had to remember this crazy darks.tonytiger.org.uk or so. It's probably still there. Was it Bash or was it something else?
So, yes, we did inherit a whole bunch of stuff that Tony wrote, and that was kind of what I was recreating. But also, Stuart Langridge had written a Python tool for Bad Voltage Podcast that did a whole bunch of uploading to YouTube and uploading MP3 files, right, and posting their episode in their discourse. So I took the source code of Stuart's tool, which was written in Python, and I took like the reference scripts that Tony made, and I created a new thing that suited our, you know, podcast publishing workflow. Anyway, that was 10 or 11 years ago. I wrote PodPublish and it's still serviceable, but I didn't want it to be Python. As much as I like Python, I don't like working with the dependencies in Python. Mm-hmm. And for the three of us, when we want to share tools, actually Python becomes kind of inconvenient at times because we're using different operating systems and there's different Python dependencies, la, 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 and I just didn't want to do it. And I saw this as an opportunity to learn Go and embrace the whole single binary thing.
Before we get angry letters from Pythonistas, can I just point out, I still love Python and I still use it for quite a lot of things. It is my, I reach for Python and I love UV for dependencies. So like, if you're going to get angry at Martin, not me.
I still do like Python, but I wanted to overcome that. I wanted to create single tools, single binaries, works on Mac, works on Linux, no fuss. So Go it was. I've written some stuff in Rust recently to sort of, you know, learn Rust a bit more thoroughly. I understand the advantages of Rust. I've never really written anything in Go until I started these projects, and it turns out I really like Go. Go is a very compatible with Martin language. It has some of the similar properties that I like about Lua, not in terms of the language per se, but Lua, you can fit the whole of the Lua language in your head at one time. And the same is true of Go. There isn't a lot to the language syntactically, and I really like that. And it's very natural and easy to work with. And I've loved writing Go. I actually enjoy the act of writing code in Go.
It's quite helpful that there is only one accepted way of writing Go, and they thoroughly enforce that with the tool chain. So there's no chance of you learning the wrong way to do it and having to poke that out of your head at some point in the future.
Yeah, it's been a delight. So whilst I understand the benefits of Rust, I'm not saying Rust is better than Go or Go is better than Rust. I see the benefits of both. But from this point forward, Go is going to be my go-to language for writing new projects. I've really enjoyed the process.
Once you take the audio that's been edited by someone, and this I'm being generic because anyone could take this code, I guess you're putting it somewhere, and someone could take the audio and then feed an image in and some settings or whatever, and out pops what, an MP4 that has some animation on it or something. I know that anyone who's watching this on YouTube right now will be seeing the result, but anyone who's not could go to our YouTube channel, link in the website, that will show what that looks like, right?
Yeah, so I've written two tools. One is called Jive Drop and the other is called Jive Fire. And Jive Drop is what you use to produce the MP3 audio. So yes, it takes the audio file that you and Mark have produced and it encodes that to an MP3 in this case. And it also embeds the cover art for the podcast and some metadata about that particular episode. And that's what we upload and is embedded in the feed. But, you know, instead of writing a script that calls FFmpeg, the way that Jive Drop works is I found a project called FFmpeg Go, which is actually a small statically compiled FFmpeg library that comes bundled with Go bindings for the FFmpeg API. So instead of sort of putting together an FFmpeg command chain with all the switches and what have you, you actually get to drive the FFmpeg API at a really low level. And you can do some cool stuff with that. So for the MP3 encoder, there's not a lot of clever stuff that needs to happen other than like work out how long the audio is and, you know, mix it down from stereo to mono and all of those sorts of things. But you can then encode it frame by frame. And because you're programmatically encoding the audio, it gave me the opportunity to reach for some of these modern Unix UI tools in the command line and actually make very pretty animations and progress charts of what's going on. So you get nice progress bars and, you know, ETA on how long it's going to take and all that sort of stuff.
Last year, I wrote a thing in Python that did call FFmpeg, you know, brutally on the command line in order to composite 4 video files and some text on screen to take the videos from my mini in-car cameras and smush them together. And now you've got me thinking, maybe I should do it in Go because it works, but I do feel it's kind of inelegant. It's brutal and it works to just call out to the command line. And that's the thing you do, isn't it? You put a wrapper around a command line thing that is powerful and does the thing you need, but it feels a bit brutal.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point, right? So if you look at something like Owncast, which I contributed to a year or so ago, they're calling FFmpeg directly. So they're shelling out to FFmpeg, the command line tool, to do things like receive your stream and encode it and all the rest of it. And if you remember, at that time, what I was doing was a whole bunch of fixes to make it work with FFmpeg 4, 5, 6, and 7, in order that it would work on every distribution and every packaged version of FFmpeg. The beauty of this solution is because it's a bundled static library of FFmpeg, it's the same consistent, exact same version of FFmpeg that you've got embedded for everything you do. So you never have to worry about where you're distributing it, if they even have FFmpeg, and if they do, what version of FFmpeg is it? So that was why I really liked this, because it fit that whole single binary approach. And the other thing I learned about is I wanted to make it really easy for you and Mark to use this tool. And whilst we have assets for the fonts that we use and the cover art, I didn't want to have to say, oh, put the font in this directory and the cover art in this directory. And I discovered that in Go, you can embed assets inside the Go binary. So our cover art and font and a whole bunch of other assets that we use is embedded in the Go binary. And the default operation is to assume you're making a podcast for Linux Matters and it automatically uses the cover art and color scheme and fonts and what have you from the embedded assets in the binary to make it really easy for us to just reproduce and use.
I can see how people have gone along with this story up until the point you know, where you said FFmpeg, you know, bundled, yes, that makes sense. And then when you said you shoved a font and a PNG file in there, because who would want to use this for any other podcast? Yeah, okay.
Well, no, I
again, so, hate mail to Martin.
No, it's fine. It's fine. The default operation, it assumes it's us, but there's a whole bunch of switches where you can say, my cover art is here, my font is here, and you can actually tune it for your own podcast.
But it ships with the font and the image right in there anyway.
It's tiny. It's tiny. It's fine.
Brilliant.
But then there's Jive Fire, and there's a whole lot more going on with that. And that produces an MPEG-4 video for YouTube. And this is where having that programmatic control over the FFmpeg API was really helpful, because we wanted to make beautiful visualizers. So the most beautiful audio visualizer I know of is Carver, which, if you're not familiar with it, is one of those brilliant modern Unix command line tools. Go and grab it and install it and play some music. You'll love it. So I grabbed the algorithm from Carver and re-implemented that in Go. And the way that Jive Fire works is that it pre-analyzes all of the audio in a first pass to figure out where the peaks and the lows are, and builds a sort of a matrix of the whole audio file and calculates all of the Fourier curves and everything to do the visualizer. And then in the second pass, it creates all of the animated streams frame by frame and feeds those frames into an encoding process. So this has got a very low level control over FFmpeg, multiplexing the audio with these composited frames that I'm making in order to produce an animated video out the other side.
And you've re-encoded all 69 episodes before this one with that. So we've got a whole new set of videos, and you have to listen to every episode to watch all of them and make sure. Have you done the QA by, making sure that all these videos are perfect? Wonderful. And you're going to put these somewhere that people can get hold of them, are you?
Yes. So we have a brand new github.com/linuxmatters GitHub org. And in there you will find Jive Drop and Jive Fire. The FFmpeg Go project I absolutely love, but it was a little bit old, so I've forked that. I'll be talking about that in a future episode, so you can find that there. I'm working on another tool in the family of tooling that we will be using going forwards. But I've loved using Go. It's made doing something that I thought would be really hard quite straightforward and simple, and I've really enjoyed working on these projects.
I've been playing a new game, and you'll be delighted to hear it does have roguelike elements.
Yeah. Wonderful.
I've missed these moments.
So have I. What game have you been playing, Mark?
I have been playing Hades 2.
Ah, if I remember correctly, you absolutely loved Hades, the original.
I did, yes. So Hades, the original, is probably the most mainstream modern roguelike game. It came out a few years ago. It's from Supergiant, who made games like Bastion and several others since. But it's a sort of isometric, dungeon crawly kind of game. Elements of it remind me of like the original Diablo a bit. But it's very fast paced, very action, fighting, high intensity stuff. And Hades 2 is the sequel, which has been in early access for a while now. But I have not had a great time playing early access games in the past. So I managed to hold myself back until it was actually released. And then I got it on the Steam Deck.
Remind me which Steam Deck you have. Do you have the modern fancy OLED one or the old terrible rubbish one that you should upgrade? Christmas is coming.
Yes, I choose not to answer that question on the basis that I might incriminate myself.
Understood.
But no, I got the original 512 gigabyte model, I think.
Nice.
And it's still going strong. And this game runs absolutely beautifully. In fact, the original Hades I had on the Switch, because I think I got that before I had the Steam Deck. And this runs absolutely beautifully on the Switch. It is not too sort of graphically taxing. It's not like a big first-person 3D environment. It's like hand-drawn, isometric sort of 3D-ish graphics, but not like yeah, detailed 3D models. It's more like cartoony kind of thing. And yeah, it runs really smoothly, even with some of the quite intense, lots of characters on the screen, lots of fast-paced action.
When you say it runs smoothly, you're not just talking about like on the deck, because you plug it into, you know, cables and have it on a big screen telly. So you're looking at a big version of the game.
Yes. So in fact, the funny thing was I had it so that it was set in handheld mode, that it would limit the frame rate to save battery. So I was playing it on screen at full frame rate, and then I unplugged it. I was looking at it on the little screen, and suddenly I thought, oh, this is terrible. Why is it so juddery? And then I realized that was why. So yeah, but it yeah does run. If you up the frame rate to 60, it does play very smoothly handheld as well.
So your love of roguelike games is well documented on this podcast, and you've said that Hades was great. So how does the sequel compare to the original, and what's different?
Well, Hades 2, in terms of the story, is a direct sequel to Hades. So it's based around Greek mythology. And the original, you were the demigod son of Hades, the lord of the underworld. And you decided you were going to escape from the underworld. In the sequel, you are his sister, the demigod daughter of Hades, in a situation where Hades has been dethroned by Kronos, the titan of time. And you're... Mm-hmm. Gonna try and kill him, basically.
Of course.
Yes.
A tale as old as time.
A tale as old as time. But it is a much bigger game, because there are actually in the original game there was one route which you followed through the game. In this game, there's two routes that you follow to sort of explore different parts of the storyline. The basic setup is the same. You go through a series of rooms, you fight enemies, and then you encounter the gods of Olympus, who give you boons which power you up, and a few other ways of powering up. And the more you play, the more you unlock, the stronger you get, the easier it is to win.
One of the common roguelike elements is a floor and lots of rooms and corridors and
yes.
Yeah, between, and you navigate this floor until you've like collected, killed, done everything, opened everything before you move to the next floor. Is it the similar kind of like levels of thing where it scrolls around in a large arena kind of thing with little rooms and cubbyholes, or is it just one big open space, or how does that work?
It's sort of in between those. So you go into a room and then you fight what's there until you've killed everything, and then you get your reward, and then you have a couple of choices to take, and you can see what reward you will get in each of those choices, and then you go there and you're in the next room, and you keep doing that until you've completed that floor, and then you fight the guardian at the end, and then you move on. And
right.
Each path has four floors, as it were, with a big boss at the end.
Is it constantly saving, or do you have to get to a certain point to save, or is there a permadeath option? Like how do you progress, and can you like die properly?
I'm not sure if there's a complete permadeath option, because I don't think that works. I mean, the idea of the game is that you are an immortal. So when you die, you return to the bit of the underworld where you started.
Clever. Mm. That's a handy game mechanic, yes. Isn't it?
But yes, there is auto-saving throughout. So as you enter each room, it auto-saves. As you collect each power-up, it auto-saves. And then when you're in between runs, as you unlock things, it auto-saves. So you can, at any point throughout a run, you can basically quit and pick up where you left off next time, which is
nice.
Handy. Yes, because I have had a few where, you know, I've sort of got halfway through a run and I'm thinking I really need to go to bed right now.
Have you got any idea of how far through the whole game you are? Do you know?
Well, on one of the routes, I've got to the last boss, and on the other route, I've got to almost the last boss, but I know from experience from playing the previous game that beating the last boss is far from the end of the game. Uh-huh. So I've still got quite a way to go yet. And yeah, there's still plenty of things for me to unlock. One of the interesting things I found out about playing this game, and to an extent playing the previous game as well, is it is, if you'll pardon the pun, a bit of a Trojan horse for learning about Greek mythology, because all of the characters you encounter are various characters from Greek myths. I've been watching Richard Osman's House of Games, it's a quiz show where one of the rounds is called Highbrow Lowbrow, where they ask everybody two questions which have the same answer, and one of them is very highbrow and one of them is like lowbrow about like popular culture and things. And yeah, occasionally they'll have a highbrow question about, you know, which Greek god who is sister of this was the representation of the moon. And I'm like, oh, I know this because I was playing Hades last night and
does
I was
make
talking
it highbrow
to
or does that I learned this from well, I learned this from going to Oxford. I learned it from playing a video game.
Yes, I think maybe they'll have to revise it for the next series of House of Games.
You've spoken enthusiastically about Hades and Hades 2. Are they available in a bundle on Steam for anyone that's listening to this and wants to get some Hades action?
I don't actually know. I haven't looked at buying Hades because I already have it on the Switch. So I just bought Hades 2 as it was. But I'm sure they'll come up in a sale or maybe in a larger Supergiant bundle, which will definitely be worthwhile because Supergiant games are generally excellent.
I have been doing some intense grummaging, and by this I mean I fixed a bunch of issues in a project I started about a year ago, and the project is called Grummage.
I remember this.
Yes. It's written in Python. It's a 2E, like textual user interface front end to a tool called Gripe, and the idea is it allows you to rummage around in vulnerability scans. Hence the name Grummage, Gripe, Rummage, Grummage. And I'm so good at naming things, I know. and the idea is you feed it an SBOM, a software bill of materials. It can then feed that to Gripe, generate a list of vulnerabilities that the SBOM may reveal are in whatever you scanned to generate the SBOM. So you generate an SBOM from a container or a directory or a repository or something. It's just a document that lists all the software. And then Gripe has this database of vulnerabilities, and it can correlate this package of this version from this origin may be vulnerable to this thing. And the output of Gripe is either like a table of text, like a list of all the vulnerabilities and what version it's fixed in and all that kind of stuff, or a giant JSON file. And both of them are a little bit impenetrable, I found. That's why I made this thing called Grummage. And it was good fun to make. The main part of making it was because I quite liked a text user interface that someone else, when I worked at Anchor, had made. And because I liked the textual user interface, I thought, I should have a go at making one of those. I quite like terminal-based user interfaces. And so I wrote it in Python using this library called Textual, which allows you to create common user interfaces with tree views, text fields that you know can scroll, and buttons you can press and stuff, either with the keys or with the mouse. So that's the history of Grummage.
So your time at Anchor has a lot to answer for, because the UI, TUI and CLI elements of Jive Drop and Jive Fire that I spoke about earlier use Bubble Tea and Lip Gloss, which I only knew about because you told me that's what was being used in Sift and Gripe themselves. So that's what I learned when I was doing my Go user interfaces.
Yeah, both Sift and Gripe are written in Go. I didn't really want to write this in Go. I know it might have been the right thing to do, but actually I liked the look of Textual, so I used
it
that.
It's very
I know there are some nice tools to make graphical user interfaces, text user interfaces in Go and Rust, but I went for Python. The problem with it is it was kind of lashed together in a bit of a hurry, and I got a release out the door, and I published it on PyPy, like a 1.0. I started playing with it again recently, and I realized there's a whole bunch of usability issues with it. One of the first things it does when you launch Grummage is it checks to see if you have the Gripe binary already. And if you don't, it will go and get it. And then it needs to launch Gripe. And Gripe then has to go and find the vulnerability database, which it downloads from Anchor's website, and then unpacks it. It does what's called rehydrates the database, which basically means it builds the indexes. And that can take a little while. And I know it's doing that but any other user would just see a black screen and think that the application has completely crashed or it's just locked up or something. And it's even worse if it's a really big SBOM. Let's say, for example, you created an SBOM of a PyTorch container or a Hugging Face container or something that's got a lot of stuff in it. That SBOM could be a very large document. It could be megabytes, many megabytes of JSON. And so Gripe can take a while to munch through that after, you know, it's downloaded and updated the database. So there's a lot of opportunities for me to inform the user what's going on. And so that's really what I wanted to do, is improve the user interface. And it was a bit of a lesson for me to understand how I could add extra bits to make the user interface a little bit more friendly for people who weren't familiar with what was going on at the time. And I discovered that Textual has a number of things that made it better as I built the user interface. So one thing I did was add pop-ups, little pop-up in the middle of the screen that tells you it's doing something. And it's really quite nice because it's got like four little dots, like showing you there's something happening going on right now. And it does that while it's doing some of the operations like downloading Gripe or downloading the Gripe database, and also tells you at the bottom of the screen the little status bar. So if you're either looking at the middle of the screen or you're looking at the bottom of the screen, you're going to see what it's doing. It like tries to like punch you in the face, but it does render the rest of the UI in the background, which it didn't do before. You just got a black screen. So at least now it renders the UI, and I had to work around the fact that if I render the UI, it becomes live and the user might start pressing things. And so I had to block the UI so you couldn't click on things while it's downloading until you wait until it's got Gripe, got the database, processed the SBOM. Right, now I'll release the UI so you can actually use it.
Now, I have to say that I think you and I are really sort of leaning into the whole modern Unix ethos with the UI, because I've seen these improvements running that you've described. And it's not just some dots that animate across the screen. They're sort of subtly color-coded through sort of, you know, hues of blue and indigo and sort of, you know, ultraviolet and what have you. It looks beautiful.
I can't take any credit for that bit. That's the Textual library. It's just like, you know, put a progress thing on the screen. Okay. And it does it.
Yeah. Like, but it does look beautiful. It's definitely a modern Unix tool, you know, in terms of the visual presentation now.
Yeah. There's another part of the UI where I thought, I don't really want to keep punching in the face with a blue box in the middle of the screen and lock up the UI while it's doing something, because some things are a shorter period of time. So, for example, if you're viewing a vulnerability and you want to get more detail, there's a feature in Gripe called Explain. And if you press the E key while you've got a vulnerability highlighted, it will call Gripe. And Gripe will then interrogate the database and find the vulnerability and tell you why that vulnerability is happening in your container, like which file, which package, like why. And it's got a little explainer with URLs to NVD and other places. So you can understand, like, give me more information. But in order to do that, it takes a little bit of processing time. And so when you press E, instead of punching in the face in the middle of the screen, you get a little kind of toast notification in the bottom right-hand corner that says, I'm getting an explanation for that vulnerability. And then when it's got it, it does another little toast notification. Now, I'm not 100% convinced about those, because there's two of them every time you press E. But I don't think many people press E all the time. It's a kind of advanced feature that not a lot of people use. And if your screen resolution is quite low, they appear over the top of some of the content. If you look at the video on the Snapcraft page, you'll see it. But I don't think that's going to be a problem for most people, because I think most people would run it at a slightly higher resolution, so it wouldn't interfere with the UI. Mm-hmm. It's only in that video it looks a bit cramped, but it's cramped because I'm trying to fit it all in a little video that goes in an app store. Yeah. You know, it's quite hard. But the other thing I did was I changed the names of some of the things on the screen, and I added a search option as well. So you can press slash, because you can use the Vim keys to navigate. I thought, well, I'll add the slash to search. And so you could search for a CVE and it would jump to the first occurrence. Oh, nice. And open the tree up and put you on that element. And if you press slash again, it will take you to the next occurrence. And so you could cycle through all the occurrences in the tree of that vulnerability or that package or whatever it is you're searching for. Mm-hmm.
Is the slash to search thing something that Textual has as a thing, or did you have to write that?
No, I added that.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and you can search backwards as well, in the same way as you do with, I think I added that.
Question mark?
I know I had that in my head. Yeah, question mark. I think I added that, or maybe I didn't. I can't remember. Anyway, I added search because actually I put it in the readme that it was there, thinking I'd done it, but it hadn't done it, and it wasn't. And I thought, oh, well, I'm going to have to add that as well. But the thing was, this whole process was, there were a bunch of issues that I wrote when I initially published it and thought, oh, I need to fix these things. And then there were some issues that other people had filed. And then there was ones that I thought, oh, God, that looks awful. I should fix that. And so I just fixed those along the way. And then once I'd done it all, I thought, well, this is deserving of a 2.0 because it was only a 1.0. So I published a 2.0 and I put it in PyPy. And I've also put it in the Snap Store. And I think I might have put it in Homebrew as well, actually. So it's like everywhere. You can get hold of it. You can brew install or brew search Grummage and you'll find it, or pip install it or snap install it. I know it's a very niche thing. And it has almost no users, I'm certain. But maybe that's because it wasn't very good previously, and now it's a bit better. And so it's more usable and more friendly. And, you know, I'd love for people to try it out if you're in the, you know, the need for displaying vulnerabilities in SBOMs.
Yeah, I think it's a good entry point to that whole thing. So you've given it quite a makeover in this release. So are you finished with sort of these big changes now? Is it going into sort of a gentle maintenance mode, or do you foresee any other big changes in the future?
One decision that I really need to make is, there's actually another tool that I made at around about the same time called SBOMage, which is just viewing an SBOM. If you're not interested in the vulnerability stuff, you just want to view the contents of the SBOM. And I made that a separate tool. And I can't quite decide whether I want to merge the two together and make it just one thing that can view the SBOM, because it already loads the SBOM. I've just got to give it the smarts to like display it in the same way I display the vulnerabilities. And it might be nice to switch between like the two modes.
Right.
And I'd have to do a bit of re-engineering, because at the moment it downloads Gripe, whereas if all you're doing is viewing the SBOM, you don't need to download Gripe. You don't need to download the vulnerability database. And so it potentially could be both. And at the moment, they both look very similar, but everything I implement in one, I then have to go and implement in the other. And it's a bit daft having two tools that do largely the same thing. The same UI, tree view on the left and fields on the text view on the right and status at the bottom. It's a bit silly. So I think what I might do is deprecate SBOMage and just keep Grummage, but make it do both tasks and try and figure out how to do that in a tasteful way. Like maybe it launches and opens the SBOM and displays the SBOM, but if you press V for vulnerability, it then goes and gets Gripe if it can't find it, downloads it and all that kind of stuff. And it's not really a tool that I would use on a daily basis. It's something that I'm using as a means to learn a bit more about, partly about Python and partly about textual and partly about creating applications, but also about the whole process of publishing them and maintaining them, because I've not got a lot of experience of publishing things outside of the Snap Store. And most of those things are other people's software. So this is like my own thing that I made, published in a bunch of places. And that's all, you know, good learning for me. So I'm quite enjoying it. And if I do continue maintaining it, then that's good. There'll probably be stuff to learn there. If I don't, then it's all free software and anyone else can fork it or maintain it if they want.